Okay, the next concept that we're going to talk about is a Malacca Sheino Tzricha Lehufa. This is literally work that's done for a different reason. So normally a prohibited act remains prohibited regardless of why you're doing it. So, for example, what if you are eating non-kosher food, but you're not doing it for culinary benefit? You're not doing it because you're hungry and it's going to satisfy your hunger, or you like the taste of whatever the non-kosher food is. You're doing it to win a bet. You know, for some reason you decide you're going to go on the TV show Survivor, and you know one of the things that you got to do is see how many tree grubs you can eat before the other guy. You don't want them. You don't like them. You're not interested in the taste. You're not interested in eating them. You're getting no benefit from them at all. In fact, you hate them. The only reason you're doing this is to win a prize, to win a bet. It doesn't matter. What we're saying is that normally it doesn't matter why you're doing something. If it's a prohibited act, it remains prohibited, regardless of the reasons for doing it. Okay. So, let's look at a piece of halacha here. For Shabbos laws, however, if you do a biblical prohibition for the wrong reason or for the wrong purpose, it turns that prohibition from a biblical prohibition to a rabbinic prohibition. So relative to the laws of Shabbos, intent does make a difference. So if I'm doing something for a different reason and I perform an action that would be biblically prohibited, but that wasn't my intent, then it's a rabbinic prohibition. It's no less a prohibition, but nevertheless, it turns it from a biblical liability, where it could be death, to a rabbinic liability, where I've got to bring a sheep or a goat. Make sense? So let's look at an example. So normally, if I take an object and carry it from inside a private domain out into the public domain where I have no eruv, that would be a biblically prohibited to move the object from one location to another via carrying. So, for example, what if I want to take the trash outside? So, I'm going to take the trash from a private area out into a public area where there's no eruv, but I have no interest in carrying the trash from point A to point B. That's not my intent. I have no intention of moving an object from a private domain and setting it out somewhere else in a public domain for the purpose of moving an object from point A to point B. It's stinky. I want it out of my house. I just want to get rid of the bad odor. So what we're saying here is in that case, I have done a biblically prohibited act, but I've done it for a completely different reason. I haven't done it to carry an object from point A and set it down in point B as my primary intent. My intent was, I need to get rid of this stinky trash. So, nevertheless a prohibition, but a rabbinic prohibition now, not a biblical prohibition.
So would moving it be the secondary?
No, we're not talking about a secondary action here. We're talking about a primary action. So, the biblical prohibition would be to carry an object from a private domain into the public domain, setting it down in that public domain where the intention was to move that object from point A to point B. That was my whole intent. Here, I just want to get the trash out of my kitchen because it's smelly. I have no intention of carrying an object from point A to point B for the sake of moving it from that point to this point. It's a fine line, but what I've done here is now created a rabbinic prohibition versus a biblical prohibition. So this is what we're talking about work done for a different reason. It has the effect of lessening the type of prohibition.
So yesterday when I brought in a diaper and wipes with my grandson so that his dirty diaper could be changed, I need to go get a goat.
Oh, yeah.
No, you just have to check with the rabbi. He'll tell you we have diapers and wipes for sale here. I think we have plenty of them in the house.
For sale
in
the Shabbos.
Before the fact, after the fact.
For sale in the Shabbos?
After the fact, he needs to talk to you about the room.
Too late, I did.
Well, okay, it's in your house, so
that was the error.
No, there's no error. So carrying from outside to inside. Okay, so a couple more examples just to make sure this one's clear. So extinguishing a flame in order to have absence of light. is a rabbinic prohibition. The biblical prohibition against extinguishing flame was because you needed the carbon black, you needed the black ash from the flame in order to do something, like to create ink. So the biblically prohibited labor of extinguishing flame is where you have a use for the carbon that comes from the flame. If all I'm doing is putting out the light because I want to be able to sleep and I need dark, it's nonetheless a prohibition, but it moves it from a biblical prohibition to a rabbinic prohibition. Make sense? One more example. So, two examples. So the halakha that comes from this. So the sages permit this type of violation, doing something that would normally be a biblically prohibited violation, but for a different reason. The sages permitted this kind of violation for limited circumstances, in order to prevent injury to the public. So, for example, hunting on Shabbos, going and killing an animal on Shabbos, any kind of animal, would be a biblically prohibited activity. But what if inside the house there's a bee? And people may be allergic to that bee, and if it stings them, I mean, it could be a serious medical situation. They could go into anaphylactic shock, and now we got to go to the hospital, they could die. So I can't trap an animal normally on Shabbos. I can't kill an animal normally on Shabbos. But in the case of, I'm not really interested in trapping the animal to eat it or trapping the animal to have its hide or killing it for the sake of eating it. I'm protecting the public. I'm allowed to trap that bee and let it go outside, or I'm actually allowed to kill that bee because it's an activity that would normally be biblically prohibited, but I'm really doing it for a different reason, and therefore it's only rabbinically prohibited. And the sages have said that in the case of protecting the public, I can do that rabbinically prohibited action.
For yourself.
Not just saving the life, it's actually just protecting, because we knew about that.
Injury to the public. Yeah, save one.
So it wouldn't apply to a fly.
Wouldn't apply to a fly. Flies don't kill anybody, there's no danger.
They're carrying terrible diseases.
Now, in a case, flies can carry terrible diseases, and if we were in a situation where there was some active plague going on, like maybe with mosquitoes, and there was a good possibility that that mosquito bites somebody or that fly lands on somebody, it will transmit disease. Okay, now we can kill it.
But if there's no active plague or any active... So protecting the public, would that include the person, the individual, like yourself, or oneself?
The reason that they say public is because there's a wider potential for, you know, somebody that may be adversely impacted or hurt by the thing. If you are allergic to bees and you're alone in your house, but if you get stung, it'll be anaphylactic shock, kill it.
Or just trap it. Check it outside.
If you're allergic, you have to be very careful about the manner in which you trap it. Otherwise, you're going to anger the bee and create a bad situation because you're alone. There's nobody to take you to the hospital. Okay? All right. So that was another one.
But saving a life kind of overrides everything.
Saving a life overrides everything. In fact, if it's a case of saving a life, you're not even allowed to think about, well, gee, how can I do this in a way which violates Shabbos less? That is a violation of the concept of you do whatever it takes to save somebody's life. Okay. Itasek. Literally, it means involved. So the halakha that comes from this concept is one who violates a biblical prohibition on Shabbos in a manner that they are completely unaware of the violation because they're focusing on some other aspect of the action, they are not culpable. Remember the term we talked about at the beginning. They are patur. Right? Even though you're doing something that's prohibited, you have no obligation to even bring an offering. It's not mutter, it's not 100% permitted. It's just that we're not going to hold you responsible in any way for the prohibited action that you did if you were completely unaware that it was going on because you were focusing on something else. So as usual, it kind of helps to have something concrete to dig your teeth into. So here's an example. So I'm walking down the street, Quincy, we're going to get to yours now, and I'm completely unaware that the house that I'm walking by has a motion detector that when I walk in front of it, it's going to turn the light on. Okay? There's actually one of those houses on one of the paths that you can use to walk here to shul.
But you're aware of it.
Well, that's why I'm going to talk about another concept later. I'm aware of it, so I can no longer take that path. Also because I happen to know it's an incandescent bulb. So
we won't ask you how you know that.
So if I turn that light on, and I didn't even know it was there, that it would be a prohibited action. My causing that light to come on would be a prohibited action. But I didn't even know about it, and I'm just focusing on walking to shul, and all of a sudden this thing happens over here. We say, this is a case where I'm involved, but I have no liability. I'm not culpable. I don't have to even bring a... I don't have to see Quincy about getting a ghost.
So if somebody was reading in a low-light room and somebody accidentally turned the light on for your benefit, that...
All right. Well, that's really a different category. But if they turned the light on knowing it would benefit from you, you're not allowed to derive benefit. If they turn the light on to benefit themselves... They're not Jew. Not Jew. They turn the light on to benefit themselves. They didn't care whether you were in the room or not. Then that's what we call additional benefit, and there would not technically be a prohibition from you also benefiting from that light. But if there was any chance that non-Jew went in the room and did it for you, you're not allowed to benefit.
So the whole concept of Shabbos Kodesh is thrown out the window on that.
Absolutely, 100% thrown out the window. You can't have somebody do something for you on Shabbos that you could not legally do for yourself. So you cannot use the Shabbos. Always. This is a bogomyser that people... Remember at the beginning of the class, I said... This is an academic discussion. Do not use this to create your own logic for why it would make perfectly good sense. So that came from one of those where somebody said, oh, I can't do it, but a non-Jew could do it. Hey, here's an idea.
I always thought that sounded wrong.
It is wrong.
Turn on that light switch.
It is wrong.
But it's a different category.
It's a different category. Okay. So, one note. This is different than a psich resha, okay? In a psich resha where the result is unintended or undesired, that's what we're discussing. Here, you don't even know what's happening. I mean, you could walk by and not even be aware that you've turned the light on. I mean, it happened, so because it happened, should you be liable? No. You're completely not liable. Whether you're walking by and you don't even see it happen, or whether you're walking by and you go, oh, gosh. Even if you notice it, you're okay. Now that you've noticed it, you
can't go back.
Now in my case, I actually did go back on that path one other time, but I made this really wide circuit to see if there was any chance that if I didn't go right in front of it, it wouldn't turn on. They must have that thing set to, you know, anything moves within a mile. I mean, it happened the second time, so I don't go that anymore. Okay. So, there's an interesting halacha here. You're permitted to allow somebody to unintentionally violate Shabbat by psich resha, right? The light coming on, that's a psich resha. If I walk in front of it, it will come on, okay? If they're completely unaware that a prohibited act would result. So now we're back to my case. Why am I being intentionally vague about this light? I have no obligation, Penn walks to shul, I have no obligation to tell Penn, oh, don't go this way because there's a house with a light that if you walk by it, it'll go on. Okay? I have no obligation to tell him because I'm not putting him in a situation where he's going to create an act for which he's liable. In fact, I'm kind of hurting him because I'm making him only go a particular way on Shabbos. So I don't have to tell Penn about this. Now, if he finds out on his own because he notices something, okay, well then now he's got the problem. But I have no obligation to warn somebody of this kind of a situation where they're completely unaware that this thing will occur.
I find that a little bit strange.
Me too.
Is there an obligation?
The reason why is because the penalty. You're not going to be penalized if you have this unintentional turning on the light.
No. Now, here's a question. Let's say there would be a penalty. So if there's a circumstance where you know a Jew is going to end up in a situation...
You're required to warn.
You're required to warn.
But you know if Penn walks by that house, and you know that's the way he can walk or whatever,
that it's 100% probability that light will turn on.
That's prohibited. No, but that's what this concept says. This concept says if you're completely unaware of the violation because you're focused on something else, walking to shul, then
he's unaware, but you're fully aware.
So I can't walk that way. He can because he's completely unaware. He would not be liable.
And therefore,
I have no obligation to tell him.
Right, that's the part where I think maybe, you know, it'd be good if you did, but...
If his walking by there would create a violation, then I would have some obligation to tell him so that he doesn't unintentionally create a violation for which he would be liable. Here we're saying he's not going to be liable, so I have no obligation. Now, I'll take that one step further. If I know that I told Penn, hey, there's this house and this light comes on and you shouldn't go that way, if I know that when I tell him that, he's going to say, so what? That saves 10 minutes off my walk. I don't care if there's a light that comes on there or not. I'm still going that way. If I know that'll be his reaction, then I'm not allowed to tell him. Because then I'm creating a situation where I have made him knowingly violate because of his predisposition.
So it sounds like if you want a fence that drew in on Shabbos, you just have to surround his house with motion detectors and he's stuck.
That'll do it.
Get the reserve.
Or go.
Just thinking he knows about it in advance.
Okay, we are out on that one. All right. All right, we're getting there. We're getting there.
Now, why do we light candles on Friday? Don't we light candles on Friday to spread the light Friday night?
And see, and they bring a lot of
joy. Before Shabbos, not during Shabbos.
Bring light to the darkness.
We do that before Shabbos, that's right. Okay, next concept.
Okay.
Temporary work. This is touching on another question that was asked earlier. Work that is not fulfilled. One who does a biblically prohibited action that is normally permanent, but they do it in such a way that the result can't possibly last until the end of Shabbos. If you do something that is not permanent, then again, that's something we'll take a biblical violation and notch it, ratchet it down to a rabbinic violation. Because normally, the action has to be not only beneficial for the intended purpose, but permanent. So, writing, for example. If I take two letters, because the minimum is two letters, because the minimum shoresh root is two letters. So if I write two letters in ink on a piece of paper, I've done it in a way that is typically done, paper and ink. I've done it in a way that's permanent, because it's not disappearing ink. It lasts past Shabbos. I've created a biblical violation. But, you know, what if I take a toothpick and dip it in lemon juice and write on a piece of paper where, hey, it's invisible and only if I expose it to heat will it come up? Still a problem, but now a rabbinic problem.
What about if you poke wood in a wood stove, it's going to disappear pretty soon?
No, you've increased the flame. That's a biblical prohibition.
Right, but that's not going to continue.
You're not writing a letter.
So, examples.
What about a pencil?
He's talking about
no, that would be permanent. Even though you could do an act that would erase it, absent that act, it's permanent. So, for example, writing letters in an ink that naturally disappears, like maybe a lemon juice, that would be a rabbinic violation. Or writing on a computer screen. So this is the one I was referencing earlier, Penn. Technically, that would be a rabbinic prohibition, not a biblical prohibition, because the sahalacha is that letters on a computer screen, whether it's a CRT or an LCD or LED, those are not considered permanent. Even though they could stay there forever, they're refreshed and dropped and refreshed and dropped, and you don't see it happening because it happens at a very fast rate, but that would be temporary.
So you have your security monitors on during Shabbos, and it would theoretically be a rabbinic prohibition at that point to have the images displayed on there.
Correct, but the issue is, you know, why is it there? What's it being used for? Now we're back to the other situation where you're not deriving benefit, and even if you are, it's at most a rabbinic prohibition, so don't worry about it.
So would a good example be if you have a corral with animals in it, for some reason, a portion of that fence, whatever, came out so it would allow other animals out, could you go and hastily put something temporary up?
Building.
From?
No, building and completing the enclosure.
Not permanently making it,
doesn't,
right?
No, it doesn't matter. You're completing the enclosure, so it's like it's the final hammer blow, or it's completing a building, bone nails, some biblical prohibitions going on there.
So you can't temporarily complete something?
Unless So the issue is, if it is not possible for that temporary fix to last even until the end of Shabbos, until Abdallah, that would be considered temporary. But what he's talking about would certainly endure past the end of Shabbos. Now, if you went out there with
barbed wire,
with crepe paper, wrap crepe paper around the thing, where you know the first animal walks through, it's just going to break through it and continue on its way. But you know, it might look at it and decide not to go there. That might be temporary. Toilet tissue or something. Okay. So halacha. When the underlying prohibition is rabbinic, it would be permitted to do the action if the result is temporary, won't last through Shabbos, and the action is normally an action that would be permanent. So, in a situation where one's presence causes an electrical appliance to turn on or off in a way that is only temporary and could not possibly last until the end of Shabbat, if the action is rabbinically prohibited, it'd be permitted to do this act. So I'll make reference to one Quincy asked about earlier. So I'm walking through the room, and in the corner of the room is a motion detector. And the motion detector has a little red LED light, not an incandescent light, an LED light. And I walked in front of the motion detector. I have made a light come on. Is that permanent? No, it's going to go off in a few seconds. Okay? So it's not, I mean, turning a light on is normally a permanent act. In this case, it's a temporary act. In this case, the prohibition is at most rabbinic, because it's an LED, not an incandescent bulb, so I don't have the issue of fire. I may have the issue of building. But it's a rabbinic act. In this case, what we say is we don't worry about it.
You're turning on a mechanism. The light is just letting you know the mechanism is working.
The motion detector is communicating with some other part of the system, but the alarm's off. So, I mean, look, if you want to be strict with yourself, then you have the alarm company install a switch. So before Shabbos, you go and you flick the switch, and it turns off all the motion detectors, so you're not going to be turning any motion detector lights on or off. But the bottom line is, if you don't have such a switch, or you forgot to put on the switch, you don't worry about, I got to stand like this all Shabbos. You walk through your house, the little LEDs will come on and off, it's fine. Now, if it's the kind of thing like in a public building where the motion detector is flicking the lights on, or you got to use the restroom and the motion detector is making the water come out of the tap, now we got a problem. You can't use those on Shabbos. You can't go into the building where you're going to make the lights come on. You can't use the restrooms where they have automatic water and automatic soap dispensers and automatic paper towels. Stay out of those buildings.
Unless you didn't know those things were there. Like Penn walking by the house, right? Same kind of thing.
But now once you know...
Then you know.
It's a problem. Yeah.
So you walk into a room, and all the lights come on.
You're going to run.
But then
you're going to run goats. Get a lot of goats.
So...
No, serious question. Though. Like, I mean, I guess, what if it were like a... And this is going to sound silly, but if it were like a pressure... If the floor calls the lights to come on, right? Because the weight on the floor calls the lights to come on. You walk into a place you didn't know that was the case. But then you realize, because you turn around and see a big sign on the other side of the wall.
So the initial violation was unintended.
Right.
Also, by leaving the floor, you're not forcing the lights to come off, go off. Because because in a situation like that, it's going to sense that somebody's there. It's going to turn the lights on for the benefit of that person. And then if there's no pressure, at some later point, the lights will go off to preserve power.
Just like
so by you running out of the building, you're not going to immediately turn off the lights. Right. And therefore, you get the heck out of the building.
But okay. If you knew it was immediate to go to turn off.
Now we have a problem. I'm going to ask you to hold some questions until lunchtime at this point. I want to get through the material. And then if you want to do some questions during lunch, we can do that. Okay. So here we have the concept of kilachar yad, or also known as a shinui. Literally it means back of the hand, or shinui is doing something in an unusual manner. This is a very common concept when we talk about the laws of Shabbat. Okay, like if you're going to mix up some thick mixture. You can't do it in the normal way, you have to do it in an unusual manner. So when we talk about technology, electronics, let's look at the basic halakha. So one who does a biblically prohibited action in a manner that is different than is typically done on a weekday, again, we're going to notch that down to a rabbinic prohibition. So if you do it in a different way, then it moves the violation from biblical to rabbinic. So an example, if you're right-handed Then writing right-handed on Shabbat, a minimum of two letters in a way that is permanent in a typical manner, is a biblical prohibition. If you do it with your left hand, it's rabbinic, because it's not the usual way you write.
Goes.
So unlike all other rabbinic prohibitions, the sages permit this type of rabbinic violation in cases of great financial need. So we saw a case earlier where, in the case of public interest, the sages allowed something. Here, doing something in an unusual manner can be done, would be permitted, if it would be a severe financial loss. And again, don't go making your own judgments. Consult your local Orthodox rabbi. You know, this may mean different things to different people, depending upon what their financial means is. But it has to be a significant financial loss. Or severe physical pain, even if not life-threatening. Even if you couldn't die from it, even if it would just hurt you a lot, then the reason the sage is permitted, because somebody who sees it, somebody, an onlooker who sees that it's being done in a peculiar manner, sees that it's being done a strange way. So they're not going to look at you doing it and go, oh, well, that guy's Shomer Shabbos, so if he's doing it, it must be okay. They're not going to get the wrong impression. Because you're doing it in a clearly strange way. Now, I guess in this case that presumes that, you know, somebody who sees you writing left-handed knows clearly that you're right-handed. Otherwise, we're not gonna meet the criteria. So, example: what if you open the refrigerator, forgetting that the light would come on, or you forgot you didn't unscrew the bulb? So this is the one the rabbi mentioned earlier. So now what? Now I have to leave the refrigerator open all of Shabbos and all the food's going to spoil. I've got thousands of dollars worth of food in that refrigerator. What do you mean you got thousands of dollars? You know how much it costs to ship stuff here from Twin Cities? I mean, I got case lots in there. I have to pay $75 just to have it shipped to me, not just to mention the cost of the food. I can't replace it tomorrow. I've got five Shabboses to get through before I can even replace this food. This is a big deal. I got 20 people to feed every Shabbos, and they're all going to go hungry for the next 3 weeks. This is a severe financial loss, potentially. So in a case like that, if I do it in an unusual manner, it's not a biblical prohibition, turning off that light, it's a rabbinic prohibition, and because of it's a severe financial loss, if I don't do something about it, I'm allowed to do it in an unusual way. I'm allowed to close the door, even though it'll turn off the light, in an unusual way. So, for example...
Can you reopen it?
No, because now you know the light's going
to
go on.
So the one time that it's open, you need to take out...
Swap out everything you need and put it in a cooler or something.
Swap
the... Yeah. So turning off the light is a rabbinic prohibition. So this is one of the concepts we talked about earlier. Sichresha il nichel lei. And it's done with a shinui. So, what if you left the refrigerator light on and you need to remove the food? You know, you need to get food out of the refrigerator, but you remember before you open the door, oh no, I didn't go through my pre-Shabbos checklist, I did not turn the light on. I know, there's no doubt in my mind. I mean, it didn't burn out on its own while it was off. There's no doubt in my mind, I'm going to open the door, the light's going to come on. I don't want that to happen. I don't want to make that initial violation. What can I do? Well, I can make it so that the light won't come on. How? Unplugging the refrigerator. Aha! But I would have to do that in an unusual manner. So, you know, get down on your knees and grab the cord with your teeth and tug it out of the wall. Yeah, don't put your tongue on the prongs.
And don't bite really hard.
Another example. If a bedridden ill person in a hospital bed, which can only be raised or lowered electronically, you've got to press a button on the bed, they can raise or lower themselves in an unusual manner if it will help to relieve pain. Doesn't that be life-threatening? It's life-threatening, you push the buttons. But, you know, I'm in pain, I can't lay in this position anymore, or I've got medicine I have to take, and I can't take it laying flat on my back, I have to sit up or I'm going to choke. Okay? Then they're allowed to perform that electronic action that would raise or lower the bed, but it should be done in an unusual manner. You know, you don't just take your finger and poke the button like you usually would. You know, you do it with your elbow or I don't know that you could push those buttons with your tongue. Your tongue must be stronger than my tongue. I can't depress a hospital bed button with my tongue. I haven't tried it.
Just using a knuckle is not.
Using your knuckle is a typical way of doing it, I would think. All right. A couple of other concepts, and then we can talk about our example. So we have a concept called Gerama. Gerama means indirect causation. So the typical Talmudic example is, what if there's a fire on Shabbos? You can't put out the fire. But what if you fill up a bunch of clay jugs with water, and you make a circle around the fire, such that when the fire gets close to the clay jugs, it'll heat them up, and they'll break, and the water will come out, and it'll put out the fire. So it wasn't a direct action, it was an indirect action. So this is called gerama. So most authorities rule that for a biblical that gerama for a biblical prohibition is still rabbinically prohibited absent an extreme financial loss. So the whole thing with the clay jugs around the fire, that might move the prohibition from biblical to rabbinic, but absent an extreme financial loss, even that indirect action would not be completely permitted on Shabbos. It would still be a violation of the rabbinic law. So, what constitutes indirect? So there's a whole machloket between the rabbinic authorities, and we have to think about all these opinions if we're going to be making a decision about what really constitutes gerama, what really constitutes an indirect action. So one opinion is, as long as there's a time delay between the thing that you do and the subsequent action, then that's indirect. So in the case of the clay jugs, I set them out there, they don't break immediately, the fire heats them up, and later they break. I mean, 100% it's going to happen, but not immediately. So some authorities say that time delay between the action and the consequence constitutes gerama. Other authorities say, no, that's not really the factor. The factor is that there has to be some additional force. It can't be what I did is sufficient to make the secondary action happen. There has to be some additional force that comes and adds to what I did to make the secondary action happen. So in the case of the clay jugs, we'd have to say there's not really any additional force. I mean, I'm intending to put out the fire will break the jugs, but I mean, me putting the jugs there was really all that needed to happen. You know, somebody didn't need to come along after me and crack it with a hammer, right? The third opinion is that the process that you're using can't be the normal process. It has to be something different than the normal way of doing things, otherwise it's not indirect. If you do it the same way you normally do, and then later something happens, by this opinion we wouldn't say that that's indirect. So let's look at some corollary halakhas. So some authorities are going to permit gerama for rabbinically prohibited actions. So some authorities will say, as long as the prohibition is rabbinic, you can use gerama. And that's 100% okay, no problem. But then you still have to say, well, what opinions are we meeting here? What really constitutes gerama? So don't go inventing things for yourself. A second halakha that would come from this, other authorities permit gerama for rabbinically prohibited action only where the indirectly caused work is not the intended result. We call this a psich resha begrama. It's 100% going to happen, but it's not. You didn't set it up so that that's what you intended to occur. So let's look at some examples. So what if you turn on an electrical appliance that doesn't generate light or heat? What if you're simply closing a circuit, so like a fan? There's no incandescent bulb. You're closing the circuit. You're completing a circuit. And you're doing it via gerama. Now, we're not talking about a timer here. That's a separate topic. You're going to perform some act, you know, like one of these Rube Goldberg machines. So, you know, you've got this stick that's going to fall and hit the switch on the fan. And so you've got this track that you lay up next to the stick. And over here, you have a ball. And you're going to drop the ball down the tower so it hits the track, and it's going to roll down the track and hit the stick, and the stick's going to fall, and it's going to flip the switch, and the fan's going to come on. Okay, so that's gerama. It's indirect. again, you know, you're going to have to go through and say, well, does it really constitute indirect? Is there a time delay? Yeah. Is it normally the way you turn a fan on? No. Is there some additional force that you didn't start by dropping the ball? No, not really. I mean, the ball starts the whole chain reaction. So it doesn't mean you're allowed to set one of those up to put your fan on Shabbos. Another example. What about opening or closing a door in your house where you know that the increase in temperature or the decrease in temperature might cause the thermostat to turn the air conditioner on sooner or off sooner? Here we have a situation where we're not concerned about this, right? First of all, it may or may not occur. We don't know. There's absolutely a time delay. There's absolutely an additional factor where things have to heat up or cool down. And secondly, the way I normally work the thermostat is I go over and I twist the button or I, you know, twist the knob or I punch the buttons. I don't normally change temperature in my house by opening and closing doors. So here we have a case where I am causing something to occur that may be a prohibition, but I'm doing it via grama in a permitted manner. Okay, one other example. So what about the oven door? What about opening or closing an oven door on Shabbos in order to take food out, even if it hastens the thermostat coming on or off? Because like the refrigerator, right? I open the door and the cold comes out and the compressor comes on. Even more so with the oven, right? I open the door, the heat comes out, and I'm going to make fire. That thermostat's going to come on and make the element come on. So what about the situation? So let's look at it. So first of all, I have no intent of turning the oven on or off. I just want my food. Okay. So if the element is already on, right, if it's already on and heating the oven, then by opening the door, it's only going to extend the amount of time that the oven's going to be on. So in a situation where I put food in the oven before Shabbos, and the oven is on, and I'm not touching any buttons, I'm not changing any temperatures, I'm not doing anything, and I see that the heating element is on, everybody says, you can open the oven and take all the food out. No question. Can't leave food in, close the door, maybe get some more later. Everything comes out once and only once. It was there before Shabbos, it didn't go in on Shabbos. Usually, this might happen on a Friday night. It's probably not going to happen on Saturday day. You're not going to put the food in there Friday afternoon, and it's going to be there until lunch on Shabbos. It's going to be charred. But I put it in the oven before Shabbos. Shabbos comes in late, so you know I take my food out after Shabbos. When the element's on already, everybody says no problem. What if the element is off? Right? The element is off when I want to take the food out. So I'm only unintentionally making the element go on. I have no intention to make the element go on. My intention is to take the food out. Then this is what's called psik resh begrama. So we talked about that situation there. Psik resh begrama is questionable. Not everybody agrees whether you could do that. So what if you can't tell? Like, you know, most modern ovens, the element is covered. You can't even see it. So maybe there's a light that comes on that says when it's on or when it's off, but sometimes there's not even a light. You have no idea, is the element on or is the element off? This would also be a case of safek psik resha. So we said that safek psik resha, if the violation is rabbinic, you could do it. If the violation is biblical, you couldn't do it. So in the case of an oven, where you're making an element come on, is that rabbinic or is that biblical? Heating up a piece of metal at the point that it glows. So that would be problematic.
What's about a gas furnace in the winter, which goes on and off?
Yeah, so that's
a fire.
Yeah, so that's basically like the example about the opening and closing a door. You know, you set the thermostat before Shabbos, so it's coming on and off on its own. And keeping your house at a fairly constant level. The only question is, you know, what if you do something like open the front door that might cause it to come on sooner? We say we're not worried about that.
It's still creating fire, even though you've set the.
But it's doing it on
new fire.
It's doing it. Actually, it's not. It's transferring flame from the pilot light to the burner. Now, you couldn't transfer flame as a direct action on Shabbos,
right.
But if you set something into motion before Shabbos and it operates on its own, then it's not a problem. This is why electronic timers are okay for permitted devices, like turning on and off lights. No, not for your DVR to record the Ravens game. But, right, something that you set in motion prior to Shabbos that operates on its own during Shabbos is not an issue.
They play on Sundays anyways.
Not always.
This is true.
Okay, so one other point. Since hot food on Shabbos is a mitzvah, then there are some that say that we can use grama all by itself, or grama with a shinui, with an unusual manner. If we are stuck in the situation where our food is stuck in the oven and we need it for Shabbos, then we can use grama with or without a shinui in order to get our food out. Okay, one more concept. No, this is not the hardest. This isn't easy. Okay. So, this one is called Meniat HaMeniat. Preventing a preventative act. And we actually ended here in the last class, but we didn't get all the way through. So here's the scenario. There's a barrel that's filling with water from a tap that's on. So that barrel is filling with water. And as a normal sequence of events, that barrel is going to overflow, and the water's going to run out of the barrel, and there's a fire down at the bottom of the hill, and the fire's going to get extinguished. So, and this is the way the system works. It's a closed system. I mean, unless somebody turns off the tap or something else, the barrel will fill up, the water will flow out, the fire will get put out. Now, Reuven, his job is before that barrel gets full, to run over to the barrel and turn on a spigot that lets water out the other side so that the barrel never actually reaches overflowing. Therefore, the water will never flow out like it was always wanting to do and put out the fire like it was always wanting to do. Okay? Now, Shimon, his job is when he sees Reuven going to open the tap, he runs and he tackles him so he can't get to the tap. We're saying that what Shimon is doing is okay to Reuven. I mean, as long as he doesn't hurt him. Why? Because he's preventing a preventative act. Reuven wants to prevent the barrel from overflowing and do what it would normally do, put out the fire. Shimon wants to prevent that preventative act to make sure he can't open the tap and the barrel will fill like it normally does and put out a fire. Right? Putting out a fire would be a biblically prohibited act. But if the system was set up to operate this way before Shabbat, then I'm allowed to stop somebody from doing something that would stop it doing what it was set up to do. Make sense? Why the heck do we talk about this at all?
Yeah.
Because it leads to a logic concept called the grama switch. Now, it's a bit of a misnomer, because what this really is an anti-grama switch. It prevents an indirect action from occurring. Here's the way that it works. So, I have a switch that is set up to where there's a timer that counts down from 10 to 1. And as soon as it gets to 1, it sends out a pulse of light that hits a light receptor on the other side and activates a circuit. Could be used to turn something on, could be used to turn something off. This is the way it works. It counts down, it puts out a light beam, something happens. Now, what if I stick an object such that it blocks the light beam? So the thing counts down and the light beam is blocked. So nothing gets turned on, nothing gets turned off. What we have now here is a circuit that can never do what it was intending to do. The operation that it was set up to be able to do before Shabbos. So me preventing that action, that's okay. That's Meniat HaMeniat. That's preventing a preventative act. And if I don't block the light, then I'm just allowing the system to do what it would have done in the first place, which it was set up to do before Shabbos. So I actually have a circuit which could be used in devices in a valid way to indirectly cause things to go on and off on Shabbos. And there's actually an institute that has created and used this concept in a telephone. They call it a Shabbos telephone. Such that this is the way it operates. When you activate a button, you're not really directly causing an action to happen. You're causing one of these switches to cease its normal function. You're interrupting a light beam, that's all you're doing. Now, halakhic authorities have looked at this and said, well, you know, maybe this is only the sort of thing that should be used for doctors and, you know, people who have potential emergency situations where they're using the telephone. Not just for the normal Joe who wants to make telephone calls on Shabbos. Besides, there's other things downstream, like, you know, in the switching unit and the person on the other end of the telephone, if they don't have one of these devices. So it's potentially problematic. But here's the thing that I wanted to show you. Here's the thing we're going to talk about. So I'm going to jump over to... So this is what the device looks like. It's a Shabbos switch. It's a Shabbos switch. And here's the way that it works. It's actually built on this Gerama switch. So there's a little circuit in here that counts down to zero. And when it gets to zero, it activates the circuit, which would either turn the light on if it's on, or turn the light off if it's off. This little piece of plastic here doesn't really do anything other than block that little light pulse or unblock that little light pulse. So my question to you is, based on that information, can I go ahead and install these Shabbos switches in my house and use them to turn my lights on and off on Shabbos? Nick shaking his head, no. Why not?
Now that is going to take a couple minutes.
Aha. But your gut feeling is no.
Because you know the outcome. It's not like there's this uncertainty. You know the outcome.
Yeah, so the first thing is, maybe when I flip the switch, I am directly causing it, because what if I happen to flip it right at the time that light beam, you know, pulses out, and it's only because I moved it right then that it happens. So here's what they've done. There's a little light here. And when that little light is lit, it's saying, I guarantee you right now I'm counting down. And if you move the switch right now, nothing is happening. Only later, at some point when that little light goes out, will the pulse come, and therefore whatever the consequences will be, what will be what it'll be. And this thing's set up to do that normally.
This reminds me of a Shabbos elevator.
That's another concept. Okay, but what you say, but it's psichresha. I know that when I flip that switch, eventually it's going to count down, and the light pulse is going to come, and the light's going to go on. So the maker said, no, we fixed that too. We've included a probability circuit. So it's going to count down to zero, and then the probability circuit comes in. It's going to flip a coin. And if the coin comes up heads, then it'll fire the pulse of light. If the coin comes up tails, it won't fire the pulse of light. So even if I move the switch, number one, I do it when the light's lit, so I know nothing's happening. I've not caused anything. And even when I switch, it's not a psichresha. There's a probability circuit. It's not going to come on immediately, the next pulse. Maybe it comes on, maybe it doesn't come on.
Well, there's your problem.
There's my problem.
Yeah.
That's my problem.
They haven't invented true computerized randomness.
Okay, so it's not 100% random, but the fact is, I do not know that the act will definitely occur as a result of my indirect action.
Yes, you do.
But it's a prohibited act, so it doesn't matter. It's still prohibited.
Why?
If you don't know, that's like opening your refrigerator and you say, well, I don't remember if the light's going to come on or not. You say that's prohibited. Then don't open it. There's doubt.
But the refrigerator, I don't have a probability circuit. And it's not, and this is an indirect action. I mean, opening the refrigerator door, it directly causes the light to come on. This is indirect. This is drama.
Okay, so if you, which is on, up or down?
Either, it doesn't matter. It's just the opposite.
Okay, so if that switch is moved to the up position, you automatically know the light is going to come on at some time. So you automatically know, even though it may not be immediate, and it's a delayed or a deferred response.
Right. But I got two factors working here. One is it's indirect, and second of all, it's not psychresha. It's not a definite act.
It is.
Oh, I've got a probability circuit. There's a chance.
There's no cause and the cause and effect are there.
So one thing
there's time.
So one thing I have to go back to is by whose opinion am I looking at drama? If the only criteria is it happens later, I'm on good grounds.
For rabbinic. But so right? So by definition with a block of 2A and 2B, these are rabbinic prohibited actions. And so isn't this biblical with the book of life and creating and
except I've got the other factors, right? Because I've got whether it's a suffix or a ratio that I'm dealing with here.
Is this an incandescent light that's going on?
Well, let's assume it is.
Okay. You're creating the light, regardless of whether
I'm doing it.
If I throw a switch and it takes 10 seconds, 20 seconds, or 30 seconds,
I cause that
light to go on.
Yeah, because by you saying that,
it's indirect because it's grammar.
I think this is the kind of thing.
No, it's going to happen regardless of when it happens.
But you benefit. You benefit directly.
So you can see what's happening here during this discussion. So you're all on the right track. So you can actually go out to it's kosherswitch.com. There's actually a company that's made this. They're marketing it, and there are very high rabbinic authorities on this website that are saying 100% okay.
They also believe probably that it is actually red.
There's no problem with this at all. But equally, you will find people who say it's not permitted. And yeah, there's a whole discussion that we've had. But you know what it ultimately comes down to for the ones that say it's not permitted? If you look back at that discussion of what constitutes grama, look at opinion number 3. Not the normal process. Okay? What they come down to is they say, even if everything else is okay, even if we buy the halacha on psich reisha, even if we buy the halacha on grama, even if we buy all of that, the bottom line is, during the week, if I want to turn a light on or off, I flip a switch. And I cannot condone, even if everything else is 100% halachically okay, then on Shabbos I'm doing the same thing. I mean, on Shabbos I'm flipping the switch to turn the light on or off. I don't care how it operates, I don't care if everything else is okay, I'm doing it in the normal manner. So to go back to one of the original things we said at the start of class, it's not Shabbos dick.
Right.
It's not sufficiently different from the way I would normally do things during the week. So for those who say no, that's what it ultimately comes down to. It doesn't come down to it's incandescent bulb, it's psych ratio, it's definitely going to happen. It comes down to it's not Shabbos dick. It's like I do on the weekdays. And if I let this in, how is Shabbos Shabbos?
Right.
How is it any different than any day of the week?
Also, you said that the grama requires the condition of severe financial loss. Does the Meniyah also have the same restriction?
No. So the Meniyah HaMeniyah gets around the basic problem with grama. So that's why this is not grama. And when you're talking about the halakha 2a, 2b, we're beyond that because we're Meniyah HaMeniyah now. We're not grama.
I also think that this is not in the spirit of Torah.
Correct. It's not Shabbos dick. It's the usual way of doing things. Anyway, so we're going to have lunch, and I'll be happy to talk more and answer questions and things during lunch. But we did get through everything, and thank you.
Take this opportunity to thank Amber for truly a very mesmerizing 2 hours.
Illuminating. Shut up, lunch.
We're going to break now till about 12, till about 1:35, so about 40 minutes for lunch. 1:40 or so. There's various options for lunch. If you're going to have the bread, you should wash inside the kitchen for amotzi. Otherwise, enjoy. We will continue with Rabbi Gurkov in the afternoon. Rabbi Gurkov has 2 of his books for sale here. If you want to take a peek at them during the lunch break, you're welcome to. He told me they're $20 per book. If you'd like to purchase them, you're welcome to. Enjoy your lunch break. Thank you.
Thank you.